Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is Side 2 of For the Record Program 232, Can You Picture Us in London? Or How the United Kingdom Lost the Second World War. We've been talking about the proposed merger between the Deutsche Börse, the German Stock Exchange, and the London Stock Exchange. I say proposed because as yet the shareholders of the London Stock Exchange have not approved this merger, although the Germans have. And we've been analyzing this, quote, merger, unquote, as the takeover of the London Stock Exchange by the Deutsche Börse, and in turn, as that proposed merger, quote, takeover, as the culmination of the European element of the strategies proposed by Friedrich List, a pan-German economist and theoretician who wrote in the 1840s and who advocated an economically united Europe under German domination as a vehicle for unseating Great Britain as the dominant colonial power on Earth and ultimately realizing German world conquest. What we're going to do in this half hour is to analyze the role of German commercial banks in the Deutsche Börse, and in turn, the role of those German commercial banks as the principal shareholders in the proposed exchange, the IX, which, by the way, has a very significant link, or will have a very significant link, if it's realized, with NASDAQ, the American high-tech stock exchange. We're going to plunge right into the broadcast with an article from the New York Times of May 4th of the year 2000. It's called City of London and Frankfurt, subtitled A German Energized Market Merger in the New Europe. The article is authored by Edmund L. Andrews. And skipping down in the article, we read about the, in effect, takeover of the London Stock Exchange by the Deutsche Börse. Indeed, some British bankers said the merger represented a German takeover because of the use of German technology and the appointment of Mr. Seyfert as chief executive. The reference is to Werner Seyfert, the head of the Deutsche Börse. Continuing, he, by the way, is going to be the chief of the new merged exchange, the IX, if it goes through. One investment banker said it was noteworthy that high growth and new companies would be listed in Frankfurt, in effect making it the new economy center of Europe. The banker, who insisted on anonymity, added that the differing ownership structures of the London and Frankfurt exchanges meant that shareholdings in the merged companies would be heavily weighted toward the big German banks that dominate the Deutsche Börse. Speaking of those big German banks that dominate the Deutsche Börse, we're going to reprise an article that we looked at, part of which we looked at, in the first half of the broadcast. This is from the Wall Street Journal of May 3rd of the year 2000. The article is Dateline London, and it's by Silvia Ascarelli, A-S-C-A-R-E-L-L-I. It's headlined, London Bourse's Leading Role Hinges on Merger with Frankfurt. Subtitled, Likely Deal Signals a Need for Allies, NASDAQ Gains Clout. And of the stock principal stockholders in the Deutsche Börse, we see in this following breakdown, the largest stockholder is the Deutsche Bank, with 14.6%, one of those banks alluded to by the New York Times article of 5/4/2000. The third stockholder behind the German regional bourses, which own 10.1%, is the Dresdner Bank with 7.7%, then the Hypo-Vereins Bank, and the Commerzbank is fifth with 6.4%. Number eight is UBS Warburg, that's a Swiss bank about which we're going to have more to say later. What's noteworthy here is that the Deutsche Börse, which is going to dominate the proposed merger, the IX, if it's approved by London, is in turn dominated by three banks, the so-called Big Three of German banking. That is the Deutsche Bank, Dresdner Bank, and Commerzbank. And we're going to take a look at the role of those three banks in the Third Reich. We're going to take a look at the role of Hitler's deputy, Martin Bormann, in administering the finances of the Third Reich. Martin Bormann was in charge of not only finances in the Third Reich, but the finances of the Nazi Party. And we're going to take a look at the cannibalization of the financial structures of the occupied countries of Europe by not only the German banks, but the Deutsche Bank in particular, as the Nazis occupied Europe and gained control of those countries' financial structures. And in turn, we're going to take a look at the role of the Big Three in the Bormann Flight Capital Program, through which all of the liquid wealth of the Third Reich was spirited out to 750 corporate fronts in neutral countries. We've spoken about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic component of a Third Reich gone underground before. And for discussion of that, we're going to reference the definitive book about the Bormann Organization. That is Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981, and authored by the very heroic Paul Manning, one of the most heroic journalists of this century. And I've spoken about the travails that Paul Manning and his family went through many times before. In the interest of time, we're going to plunge right into the discussion. Of the role of banks in the Third Reich, we read in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, "In Germany, the big banks were the money machines that ensured the silent financing of the war Hitler was planning. In order of fiscal strength and importance, Deutsche Bank led the big three, followed by Dresdner and Commerzbank, the standing of the three still today in the Federal Republic of Germany. Fortune magazine places these among the 50 largest commercial banks in the world outside the United States." And skipping down after a discussion of the various loans made to German war industry by these various banks in the Third Reich, Paul Manning discusses the primary role of Martin Bormann in administering the banking in the Third Reich. "The Martin Bormann Nazi Party Committee on Banking consisted of 10 district industrialists and bankers. The chairman of the committee was Helmut Bornicke, who was general manager of the Brandenburger Provincial Bank and on the board of Deutsche Bank. Another member was Heinrich Hunke, who was president of the Chamber of Commerce in Berlin, on the management committee of Deutsche Bank, and an economic advisor of the Berlin district of the National Socialist Party. Another was Wilhelm Avieny, A-V-I-E-N-Y, of Frankfurt, where he was also economic advisor to the party and a management member of the Metallgesellschaft. There was Walter Yonder of Dessau, who was with the Junkerswerke. He was on the board of Commerzbank and was economic advisor of Dessau. Walter Raffelsberger of Vienna was party economic advisor for Vienna. He was an engineer, but had a seat on the board of Kreditanstalt Bankverein of Vienna, owned by Reichs and Deutsche Bank. Wolfgang Richter, an economic advisor for the Sudetenland and manager of the Braunkohlen Syndicate of Mitteldeutschland. Julius Mayer served as economic advisor of Hanover. He owned the private bank of Hanover, Julius Mayer and Company. There was Dr. Walter Scheiber, economic advisor for Thuringia. He lived in Weimar and was manager of an artificial wool company in Schwarza and a member of the board of directors of the Dresdner Bank during the final months of the war. Christian Franke, economic advisor for Munster and Westphalia, North, was also president of the Munster Chamber of Commerce and head of a large lumber company. Karl-Heinz Heuser served as an alternate to Hunke on the Bormann Nazi Banking Committee and also served as an alternate economic advisor for Berlin. This banking committee not only had government access to all German bank operations and a degree of control, but it also placed representatives on the boards of each bank. The big banks did not object, merely insisting that these men need not be party hacks but party professionals who had a feel for and understanding of finance. The bankers of Germany have always looked to the seat of their government for guidelines, and if this was what Bormann wanted, they would go along. Skipping down, during the era of the Third Reich, their period of enormous power, the banks had become virtually a second government. Bank chairmen were consulted by the Nazi Party on every economic and financial question that arose. Baron Kurt von Schroeder, a well-known banker of Cologne during these years and an economic advisor to Bormann's economic committee, commented that Dr. Hermann Josef Abs, chairman of Deutsche Bank, was particularly important to the government of the Third Reich. Quote, "His influence was mainly with the Reichsbank and with the Ministry of Economics. Abs proved very valuable to the party and to the government by using his bank to assist the government in doing business in the occupied countries and in other foreign countries. Abs enjoyed excellent relations with Walter Funk, who was both president of the Reichsbank and head of the Ministry of Economics," unquote. Walter Funk stated that the bankers and banks of greatest importance in German financial affairs abroad were Abs of the Deutsche Bank, Goetz or Rascher of the Dresdner Bank, Rodewald of the Reichskreditgesellschaft, and Radort or Aerobank. Funk added that this last-named bank, the Banque de Luftfahrt or Aerobank, confined its activities largely to the monetary affairs of France and Norway. But Deutsche Bank and the Dresdner Bank had few limitations on their activities due to their worldwide associations and prestige in finance, unquote. Even within their own organization, much of their personnel reflected the Nazi Party. Branch managers of the Deutsche Bank were to a man members of the party. Of course, management insisted that all be first-class bankers, men who had come up through the Deutsche Bank ranks to positions of authority. While the big three of German banking were vital to the funding of the German war machine both before and during the war, the Deutsche Bank was much more so, for it was the lead bank in establishing economic authority over the banks and corporations of the occupied countries. When the German armies were preparing to invade the lowlands and France, Deutsche Bank submitted to the Ministry of Economics its plan for ensuring economic control over nations about to be overrun by the Wehrmacht. Like the chemical firm IG Farben and its New Order, unquote, for the European chemical business, Deutsche Bank's plan was also named New Ordnung or New Order. It was approved by the Ministry of Economics and the Reichsbank, and when German armies moved, Deutsche Bank followed. In Belgium, control was assumed by establishing banking subsidiaries of the big German banks, which also bought majority control of existing Belgian banks. The Deutsche Bank already had its own branch in Brussels and was doing business as usual on May 19, 1940, when German troops marched into the city and proceeded to give a band concert in the Grande Place, it being a sunny afternoon. Dresdner Bank bought majority interest in Banque Continentale of Brussels and Antwerp. The Bank der Deutschen Arbeit bought into Banque de l'Ouest in Brussels. Commerzbank moved in on Banque Hanseatique of Brussels. In Holland, German banking exploitation was achieved simply by having the Deutsche Bank, which had long been interested in Handelsmaatschappij, increase its holdings on H. Albert de Barry and Company. The Berliner Handelsgesellschaft increased its holdings in the Hollandse Koopmansbank. The Bank der Deutschen Luftfahrt acquired all shares in the N.V. Hollandse Buitenlandbank, while several other German financial institutions secured majority shares in Rhodius Koenig's Handelsmaatschappen. Three subsidiaries were established by Dresdner Bank. Deutsche Bank bought majority control of Böhmische Union Bank of Prague and the Banca Commerciale Romana of Bucharest and 30% ownership of the Banque Générale de Luxembourg. It purchased controlling shares from banks in Belgium and Paris, which up to that time had owned these banks of Prague, Bucharest, and Luxembourg. The Société Générale de Belgique of Brussels and the Banque de l'Union Parisienne of Paris, which owned these banks, sold their shares to Deutsche Bank. In much the same way, this huge German bank bought majority stock from Belgian and French majority shareholders of Columbia Oil and Concordia Oil, both Romanian joint stock companies operating these oil-producing plants of Romania. These economics penetration specialists of the Third Reich handled France similarly, but with a slight difference. In the years before the war, the German businessmen, industrialists, and bankers had established close ties with their counterparts in France. After the Blitzkrieg and invasion, the same Frenchmen in many cases went on working with their German peers. They didn't have much choice, to be sure, and the occupation being instituted, very few in the high echelons of commerce and finance failed to collaborate. The Third Republic's business elite was virtually unchanged after 1940, and we've talked about the pre-war collaboration of French industry and finance and the French elite with the Third Reich and Mussolini in the miscellaneous archive show entitled Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce, specifically in the September 4th, 1994 installment of same. Once the countries had been occupied and their financial structures absorbed by the Third Reich, Martin Bormann oversaw the administration of these countries' economies as follows. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, we read, once Martin Bormann had the German banks assume majority control of the fiscal apparatus of each overrun country and of the corporations of special worth to them, the German four-year plan was the next step in total administration, determining precisely which individuals were to direct these enterprises in the occupied areas, also into which German sphere of requirement each should fall. What we're going to take a look at next is the role of the Big Three, the Deutsche Bank, Dresdner Bank, and Commerzbank, in the Bormann Flight Capital Program, under which all of the liquid assets of the Third Reich were secreted out to 750 corporations in neutral countries. This was the third major flow of 20th century capital that we looked at in For the Record program number 99, available from Spitfire. Reading of the German flight capital program to Switzerland, we read, as we move now into the role of the Big Three banks in the Underground Reich, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, about which we are speaking and about which I've spoken so many times, Paul Manning writes as follows. The movement of German assets into Switzerland had also gone well, Bormann noted from his reports. Flight capital investments had been accomplished principally through the establishment of subsidiaries of powerful German firms. Over half the total German capital in Switzerland was used in setting up holding companies representing IG Farben, Merck, Siemens, Osram, Henkel, and others. A holding company may not trade in any form. It may only hold stock in other companies, but through this device, the existing German firms and the 750 new corporations established under the Bormann program gave themselves absolute control over a post-war economic network of viable, prosperous companies that stretched from the Ruhr to the neutrals of Europe and to the countries of South America, a control that continues today and is easily maintained through the bearer bonds or shares issued by these corporations to cloak real ownership. Bearer shares require no registration of identity, for such shares are exactly what they mean. The bearer of the majority shares controls the company without needing a vestige of proof as to how he acquired them. Thus, the Germans who participated as a silent force in Bormann's post-war commercial campaign, which is sometimes referred to by aging Nazis as Operation Eagle's Flight or Aktion Adlerflug, ensured their command over the industrial and financial institutions that were to move the new Federal Republic of Germany back into the forefront of world economic leadership. More about the Swiss element of the Bormann Flight Capital Program, and note here the role of the Big Three, Deutsche, Dresdner, and Commerzbank, with their Swiss banking affiliates in helping to siphon off the capital of the Third Reich into these corporate fronts in neutral countries. Six Swiss private banks were now used by German firms in the Flight Capital Program. H. Sturzenegger & C., Rochling & Company, Johann Verli & Company, Bank Wadenswil, Basler Handelsbank, and Kreditanstalt. However, all major Swiss banks were serving the Germans in the massive movement of funds. The big German banks, Deutsche, Dresdner, and Commerzbank, all had their regular Swiss affiliations through which they worked. Deutsche had as its principal connection Credit Suisse, and also did business with the Swiss Bank Corporation and the Banque Fédérale. Funds transferred from Berlin for a client list approved by Bormann went into numbered accounts and were either held there for local investment or soon shifted to neutral nations elsewhere in Europe or overseas to be credited to the accounts of appropriate German corporate subsidiaries or else to entirely new corporations awaiting these startup monies that would enable them to go into business using German patents. As these new corporations prospered, they generated more money and profits, becoming important elements in the Bormann global economic scheme. 750 new corporations were established in the last months of the war under the direction of Reichsleiter Bormann using the technique of corporate masking perfected by IG Farben head Hermann Schmitz. A national of each country was the nominal head of each corporate structure, and the board was a mix of German administrators and bank officials, note that, while the staffing at senior and middle management levels was comprised of German scientists and technicians. In the background were the shadowy owners of the corporation, those Germans who possessed the bearer bonds as proof of stock ownership. The establishment of such companies, usually launched in industries requiring high technical skills, was welcomed in Spain and Argentina, to give two examples, because those governments appreciated that German companies would generate jobs and implement a more favorable balance of trade. Country by country, a breakdown by U.S. Treasury investigators of these new 750 German firms was as follows. Portugal, 58, Spain, 112, Sweden, 233, Switzerland, 214, Turkey, 35, and Argentina, 98. And speaking of the role of the big German banks in the Turkish end of the flight capital program, we read, Turkey, too, did a brisk business in gold and other assets. The week when three German armies were attacking in the Ardennes, German assets in Turkey on the record totaled $30 million, and the Turkish-German clearing account was $15.7 million in favor of the German government. Neither figure tells the whole story of Nazi resources in Turkey. Two branches of German banks, the Deutsche Istanbul and the Deutsche Orient, a branch of the Dresdner Bank, were depositories for a steady flow of bonds, cash, gold, bank deposits, and foreign exchange belonging to German firms and individuals. In Turkey, as in other neutrals, the Germans had also been able to achieve a safe haven for their money by preventing the normal repatriation of foreign earnings. For example, both major German banks had a policy approved by Bormann of accumulating in Turkey all annual profits of the war years rather than returning the money to Berlin. It just piled up as a bookkeeping item ready for transfer to South America or investment in Turkish business and commerce. And again, note the role of the German commercial banks, the big three, Deutsche and Dresdner in this particular case, which along with Commerzbank dominate the Deutsche Börse, and note their role in the Turkish element of the Bormann Flight Capital Program. And of the role of the big three in the Luxembourg element of the Bormann Flight Capital Program, we read from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, the German banks, Deutsche and Dresdner, remained in position, and the Luxembourg financial community continued to look to Frankfurt rather than to Zurich, London, and New York for financial guidance. What we're going to look at next is the role of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization and the principal German banks, the big three that dominate the Deutsche Börse, in investing in American blue-chip corporations. Reading from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, with such funds accumulating rapidly in Spain, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, and Argentina, Bormann and his group, who were handling the fortunes of 750 new corporations, would use these corporations in neutral countries as cloaks for investing in American companies. Skipping down. When Bormann gave the order for his representatives to resume purchases of American corporate stocks after the war, it was usually done through the neutral countries of Switzerland and Argentina. From foreign exchange funds on deposit in Swiss banks and Deutsche Südamerikanische Bank, the Buenos Aires branch of Deutsche Bank, large demand deposits were placed in the principal money center banks of New York City, National City, now Citibank, Chase, now Chase Manhattan N.A., Manufacturers and Hanover, now Manufacturers, Hanover Trust, Morgan Guaranty, and Irving Trust. Bear in mind that Manning was writing in 1981. Continuing. Such deposits are interest-free, and the banks can invest this money as they wish, thus turning tidy profits for themselves. In return, they provide reasonable services such as the purchase of stocks and transfer or payment of money on demand by customers of Deutsche Bank, such as representatives of the Bormann business organizations and Martin Bormann himself, who has demand accounts in three New York City banks. They continue to do so. The German investment in American corporations from these sources exceeded $5 billion and made the Bormann economic structure a web of power and influence. That $5 billion, by the way, was many decades ago. It's incalculably greater now. More about Martin Bormann's personal banking through the Deutsche Bank and Buenos Aires branch of same. From the FBI post-war file on Martin Bormann, we read in Manning's text, the file revealed that Bormann had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941, that he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th of 1967 had written checks on demand accounts in First National City Bank, Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. and of the reconstitution of the Big Three after World War II and the continuity of ownership and policy. Bear in mind that these are the three Big Three who dominate the Deutsche Börse and will dominate the proposed IX combined exchange with its link to NASDAQ. The Allied Liquidation Commission had separated the big banks from their branches. But when occupation ended, the banks coalesced again, and Deutsche Bank, Commerzbank, and Dresdner Bank continued their economic leadership of Germany. And I would add they did so, of course, under Martin Bormann, as they did during World War II. Of Martin Bormann's post-World War II dominance and administration of the German economy, the economy of the Federal Republic, Paul Manning writes as follows. As for Martin Bormann, this now elderly recluse, this of course is in 1981, as for Martin Bormann, beginning again, this now elderly recluse is ever a keen watcher and manipulator in the silent, gigantic struggles among worldwide industrial and financial powers. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by major shareholders and significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, he is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann. But power has shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10, 1944. What will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry. All orders come from the shareholders in South America, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. Now, note the reference there to the younger group of administrators that run the Bormann organization. Against the background of that, listen to the following. This is an article from the Financial Times of London, the weekend of April 22nd and April 23rd of the year 2000. It's about Werner Seifert, the head of the Deutsche Börse and the head of the proposed IX merged exchange with London. The article's entitled Market Maestro, and it's by Tony Barber, again from the Financial Times of London, 422 and 423. And about the heritage of Werner Seifert, we hear the following. Werner Seifert was recruited to the Deutsche Börse by Rolf Breuer, B-R-E-U-E-R, head of the exchange's supervisory board and later to become chairman of Deutsche Bank, a surprising appointment as Mr. Seifert freely acknowledged he had no expertise in stock exchanges. Note also that Seifert is of Swiss heritage and that the eighth largest stockholder in the Deutsche Börse is the UBS Warburg, formerly the Union Bank of Switzerland. Of its role in the Bormann organization, we read the following, this from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. The German connection would still be there. Not only IG Farben head Hermann Schmitz, but also the banking connection of Union Bank of Switzerland, Dr. Schaefer's bank, and Deutsche Bank, which acted in concert on so many deals involving not only IG Farben, but also big Ruhr industrialists such as Thyssen AG, the largest steel maker in Germany. So note the role of UBS, the Swiss bank, in the Deutsche Börse and the combined Swiss and Deutsche Bank heritage of Werner Seifert. And we're going to conclude with a look at the proposed or possible absorption eventually of NASDAQ into this proposed IX exchange. This is from the Wall Street Journal of 5/4/2000, article by Sylvia Ascarelli, Dateline London, and headlined, New European Exchange Links with NASDAQ. And skipping down, we read, formally, the European exchanges and NASDAQ said only that they will look into further cooperation, including cross-shareholdings. But the cooperation with NASDAQ eventually could lead to a merger of that exchange with IX, said Gavin Casey, who plans to depart as chief executive of the London Stock Exchange once the IX merger is completed. That's the end game, unquote, he said. Techies, please note. That concludes For the Record program number 232. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.